Bill and Sue. And is Sue here? And I love your pastors, and my wife's name is Sue. So whenever I hear Bill and Sue, I turn and look. It's like, so we feel right at home here. I wanted to mention, some of you may have heard me talk before, but I wanted to mention the titles of some of my books. That way I can sell them and don't have to bring them back home with me. But this one is called Prayers and Presidents. It's all the past presidents, their proclamations of prayer. Lincoln's the one who made the Day of Thanksgiving an annual event. Harry S. Truman's the one who made the National Day of Prayer an annual event. And so just a fascinating history. One of the stories that I thought I'd share is 1746, the Spanish and French were raiding the colonies in America, and there was the War of Jenkins' Ear. Some Spaniard caught a British ship off the coast of America and cut off the captain's ear, right? And so started a war. And so the Spaniards were threatening to attack the colonies, and so were the French. And so in 1746, the French were putting together an armada of like 70 ships, 13,000 soldiers, and it was going to be the largest empire in the world at the time. And they were setting off. Well, word got to Massachusetts, and the governor was William Shirley. He declares a day of fasting and prayer. They all meet in the Old South Meeting House, which was where their church would meet. And the pastor's name was Thomas Prince. And he prays, and the historian, Catherine Drinker Bowen, related that as he finished praying, the sky darkened, the winds shrieked, the church bells rang a wild and uneven sound, though no man was in the steeple. You know, dung, dung, you hear the winds blowing. And then a hurricane subsequently came up and smashed into the French fleet and scattered them, sunk them. And so 4,000 sick, 2,000 dead. What was crippled, you know, rendezvoused at Nova Scotia. And the vice admiral was so upset that he threw himself on his sword. Right? That's how they would sort of kill themselves, you know. And he missed. It took him a couple of days to die. Anyway, the main admiral was Admiral D'Anville, and he had died. And so the poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote a poem, and it's called The Ballad of the French Fleet. He says, Admiral D'Anville had sworn by cross and crown to ravage with fire and steel our helpless Boston town. From mouth to mouth spread tidings of dismay, I stood in the Old South saying humbly, let us pray. Like a potter's vessel broke, the great ships of the line were carried away as smoke or sank in the brine. And so here we were rescued, and it was a day of fasting and prayer. There's a whole lot more in that book. And then those that were at the men's breakfast heard me talk about this book, Change to Chains. And what I did is I read through every civilization that has ever existed on planet Earth. And they, believe it or not, it's not that old. The first civilizations begin in the Mesopotamian Valley over where Iraq is, and around 3,000 BC, right? 3 or 4,000 BC. Sort of coincidentally, that's when the Bible says civilization man began, about 3 or 4,000 BC. You know, actually creation was 4,000, and then they lived on the earth for about 1,000 years, and men got to the place where they could live their whole life and not even think about God. And in Genesis chapter 6, it says that they would not retain God in their thoughts. The thoughts of man were on evil continually. And God said, that's it. I'm going to destroy this place except for Noah, you know. And so that 1,000 years of people on earth was wiped out. But after the flood is when they the ark was on, most likely on Mount Ararat, and they came down into that valley, which was the same valley, the Mesopotamian Tigris and Euphrates, and began to rebuild. So that's where the first civilizations are. You get any world civilization textbook, and it says the civilizations began in the Mesopotamian Valley with Tilgath-Pileser and the Assyrians and Gilgamesh and Hammurabi and then the Egyptian pharaohs. And anyway, I bring out how I trace all these different civilizations from then until now, and the typical form of government is a monarchy. And there's only 60 centuries. So 4,000 BC, 2,000 AD is 60 centuries, 6,000 years. And 6,000 years is only 60 people living 100 years each back to back. And we've all met somebody who's lived 100 years or know somebody that's lived 100 years. You take 60 of those, right? One dies, another's born. You do that 60 times, and you're all the way back to the very beginning of recorded human civilization. So it's not that long. And, you know, probably around 60 people here, so each one of you pick a century, right? And again, the typical form of government's power concentrates into the hands of a king. And we call them different names: Caesars, Pharaohs, Kaisers, Sultans, Czars, Alexander the Greats, Julius Caesars, Aztec Montezumas, Chinese emperors. And then I go through the alternatives that were attempted throughout history. So Israel for 200 years had judges. They didn't have a king. And they got to have maximum liberty. And they could own their own property. And they could have their sheep and their cattle. And after a while, the people said, you know, we don't like this anymore. We want to be like all the other countries. We want a what? King. And so the prophet Samuel said, you're not going to like it, but here's Saul. Anyway, then I go through Athens and their attempt with a democracy. And then Rome had a republic until Caesar made himself dictator for life. And then I work our way up to America. And America, so you got the power in the hands of the king, and you'd stretch the rubber band and do something different, separate power, but it always snaps back. Power always reconcentrates. And so America, our whole constitution is just an attempt to separate the power of a king into three branches, separate it federal to state level, and then tie up this new federal Frankenstein with 10 handcuffs we call the First 10 Amendments. Our founders were preoccupied with one thing: prevent the power from reaccumulating back into the hands of a tyrant, a dictator. And anyway, unfortunately, after every crisis, we see this gradual reconcentration. So it was great that Lincoln ended slavery, but in the process, power went from the states to the federal government. It was great that Franklin Roosevelt got us through the Depression, but he concentrated power with his New Deal programs. Lyndon Johnson concentrated power with his welfare state. Nixon concentrated power with his war on drugs. And President Bush concentrated power with the war on terror. And now it's being concentrated into the federal government in a very fast rate. And so the saying is, you know, it doesn't matter if a person's title is prince or president. If he dictates, he is, in effect, a dictator. Right? So we're sort of under both parties, you know, this trend. We're moving back into the direction of the rubber band snapping back and power reconcentrating. But that's what this book's about. And anyway, then the book I talked about on Islam, most of you heard me talk about that. I give the 1,400-year history of Islam, and then I have it on a DVD as well. And then a book backfired. And I'm going to talk a little bit some of the stuff that's in this. I'm going to fast forward through a bunch of slides, but I'll just talk about a couple of them. But this is interesting. This is the first century AD. This is the Roman Empire. This is the Parthian Empire left over from Alexander the Great. This is the Kushan Indian Empire. And then this is the Han Empire in China. And China had silk and china plates and gunpowder and burning rocks called coal and all these different things. And so Europe traded. Even in the first century, Marcus Aurelius writes about receiving ambassadors from the Han Dynasty in China. And so they traded in the first century. But then as the years went on, about the 7th century is when the Muslims conquered this area and cut off the land routes, finally the Muslims conquered Constantinople, and that's when Columbus set sail. So this was the Muslim Empire. And I don't know if I went through this, but you know, Jesus never killed anybody, Muhammad did. Jesus never led armies, Muhammad did. Jesus never owned slaves, Muhammad did. Jesus never married, Muhammad had anywhere from 11 to 22 wives. And so we sort of see there's a difference there. Muslims invaded Spain, and then the Spaniards kicked them out. Muslims conquered Constantinople. I'm going to fast forward through these slides. So this is the Byzantine Christian Empire, and the Muslims control all of this. And then the Mongols come along. And then the Muslims invade the Byzantine Empire. All seven churches mentioned in the book of Revelation were all wiped out by the Muslims. So the next time you see, read, you know, to the church at Philadelphia and Laodicea and Thyatira and Sardis. And this is where Ephesus, the Ephesians, you know, and Galatia, Galatians, and Colossians, Colossae. All those cities were all Christian and they were all wiped out by the Muslims. So it really affected our history. And so the Byzantine Empire cries to the West for help. The West sends help. It's called the what? Crusades. 9 major crusades in 200 years. When the crusades end, the Muslims conquer Constantinople. And this is when they moved the bones of St. Nicholas. St. Nicholas was the most popular Greek saint. He lived around there during Roman times and was generous, gave to the poor. I tell the whole story in one of my books. But when the Muslims invaded, they would take the bones of the Christian saints and give them to the dogs. And so in the year 1087, they moved the bones of St. Nicholas to right there, Bari, Italy. And this introduced him to Western Europe. And all their traditions of gift-giving on the anniversary of his death became real popular. How many of you know the story of St. Nicholas? A couple of you? I should have slipped on that PowerPoint. But he was born in 280 AD during the persecution of Diocletian. And his parents died when he was young, and so he inherited a lot of money as an only child, and he had an uncle who was a bishop. Now, he's the most popular Greek Orthodox saint. So the Greek Orthodox Church has all kinds of history about St. Nicholas. When Vladimir the Great, the emperor of Russia, converted to Greek Orthodox Christianity, he adopted Nicholas as the patron saint of Russia. So that's why so many people in Russia are named Nicholas or Nikolai. Anyway, so there's lots of different stories. Some are more believable than others, but the fact is he did exist. He was born. He ended up becoming a bishop of a city called Myra. And being a bishop was not just an honor, it was a danger because the Roman emperor Diocletian was collecting bishops and killing him. So Nicholas was put in jail for several years facing death. But then Constantine became the emperor and he legalized Christianity in 313 AD. So this is when Nicholas is let out of jail. And then the Arian heresy starts. For three centuries, Christians didn't live long enough to argue over doctrine because they were being thrown to the lions. Well, after Constantine legalizes Christianity, that's when there's some bickering going on. The first heresy starts with a guy named Arius. And Arius says Jesus is a little less than God. And he writes this little song that's catchy. And so, like the Visigoths, were a people who immigrated into Rome, they basically adopt Arianism. And it was splitting the Roman Empire, so Constantine orders all the bishops to Nicaea to settle this thing. And the tradition is that Nicholas was there at the council in Nicaea, and he was so upset at Arius for sharing his heresy that Nicholas slapped him across the face. So jolly old St. Nick had a little temper. Better watch out if he's coming to town. Anyway, then they had Diana worship. It was sort of like the Las Vegas of the Mediterranean there in Ephesus. One of the seven wonders of the ancient world, 127 huge pillars and temple prostitutes, right? And so Nicholas was a fiery preacher. He preached against this immorality, and the people eventually tore that pagan temple down. But one story that was popular was a merchant had gone bankrupt. And back then, the creditors would not only take your house and lands, they would repo your kids. And so this merchant thought if he could hurry, and he had three beautiful daughters. He knew if they were taken, they'd probably end up in the life of prostitution. So the father had an idea. He thought if he could hurry up and marry his daughters off, the creditors couldn't take him. Unfortunately, he didn't have money for a dowry, which was needed in that area of the world for a legally recognized wedding. A dowry is where the girl's father, you know, pays money. And so Nicholas heard the problem, and late one night threw some money in the window, supposedly landed in a shoe or a stocking that was drying by the fireplace. It provided the dowry. The oldest daughter got married, did it for the second and third. Finally, the dad ran outside and caught Nicholas, and Nicholas made him promise not to tell where the money came from because he wanted the glory to go to God. And so that was the origin of the tradition of secret gift giving on the anniversary of Nicholas's death, which was December 6, 343 AD. And so these Greeks would give gifts on the anniversary of his death, December 6th. And Justinian, the Roman emperor, built a big cathedral, named it after St. Nicholas, but then the Muslims invade in 1087, and that's when they have to move the bone to Nicholas to Italy for protection, because the Muslims would, Muhammad said, leave no high grave standing, nor a work of art, without obliterating it. So that's why the Muslims destroy artwork and destroy churches and destroy statues of Buddha that were in the mountainside of Afghanistan. They destroyed the pyramids and anything that was basically pre-Islam, they consider pagan and they want to destroy it. And so the Christians moved the bones of St. Nicholas, their famous Greek saint, over to Italy in the year 1087. And this introduces them to Western Europe, and all the gift-giving, this Greek tradition of gift-giving is really popular. It sort of spreads, and it sort of distracts from Christmas. And so St. Francis of Assisi in the 12th century comes up with the nativity scene, the creche scene, the manger scene. Because he says, look, all this gift-giving is a distraction from the reason for the season. Jesus was born in the manger. All right, so we're sort of still struggling with that today. Well, the gift-giving still spreads, and it goes to Germany. And Martin Luther starts the Reformation, and he ends saints' days. He says it's too much of a distraction, and he moves all the gift-giving to December 25th and says the gifts all come from the Christ child. And so even to this day, my daughter's in Germany, and on Christmas, oh, the Christkindl's coming. Well, Christkindl is their German word for Chris, meaning Christ, and Kindle is child, a kindergarten, child garden. And so over the centuries, Christkindl got pronounced how? Chris Kringle. So Chris Kringle is a morphed pronunciation of Christkindl, which means Christ child. Anyway, The gift-giving tradition, St. Nicholas tradition, spread. Eventually, the Dutch brought it to New Amsterdam, which became New York, and the Dutch pronounced St. Nicholas Sant Niklaus, or Santa Claus. And so we would not have a Santa Claus over here had it not been for a jihad over there, right? In 1087, they moved his bones, and that started the whole thing off. Anyway, that would make for an interesting Christmas story. You know, hey, kids, gather around. I'm going to tell you a story. And then the Muslims came in and chopped off their heads. And, in Holland, to this day, they still have St. Nicholas coming, and he's dressed as a saint. I mean, he's got the bishop's hat and the mitered staff, and he comes with his robes on, his episcopal robes, and he gives out gifts to the kids. And in Holland, they still celebrate it, except in areas where the Muslims have taken over. They won't let them. But for centuries, the Dutch said that St. Nicholas comes every year from Spain riding a white horse, and it's sort of like a, you know, the idea is that Jesus would come at the end of the world to judge the living and the dead riding a white horse, and the saints would come back with him, and St. Nicholas is a saint, so he just sort of come back every year with a little mini checkup. That's where the idea came from. Well, in Norway, they didn't have horses, so he'd come back on a reindeer. And then there's the Lamb's Book of Life, and then there's the Book of Works, right? If your name's in the Lamb's Book of Life, you go to heaven, you know, and the Book of Works, if your name's not in there, you're judged by the Book of Works, and guess what? Nobody's done enough good works to outweigh the bad works, and so it's a sad time. Now, if your name's in the Lamb's Book of Life, then you're rewarded by the works that you do. Remember, Paul said there's a crown laid up for me and for everyone, you know, that serves the Lord and so forth, and then we cast the crown to Jesus' feet. But anyway, so it turned from the angels keeping the books to the elves keeping the book of the naughty and the nice. And then the saints come from where? Heaven, the celestial city, the New Jerusalem. And so over the centuries, that turned into the North Pole. And so these things were going on. That's when Martin Luther said, okay, let's get rid of this, you know, tradition. Let's say all the gifts just come from the Christ child. But anyway, so I was doing a radio interview, and in Holland, they have St. Nicholas comes from Spain riding a white horse, and he has with him his Moorish costumed helper, Zwarte Piet. And the Moors, well, the Moors were the Muslims. And they had Spain for 700 years, and they had the slave trade. Millions of Europeans were carted off by these Muslims from Spain and Portugal and the Dutch. They captured fishing boats and Greek islands, and they raided the Italian coast and Spain and Portugal. They captured one of the pilgrim ships, and they even captured 400 from Reykjavik, Iceland. They captured an entire Irish village in 1627, took the whole village to Morocco and sold them into slavery. So the Muslims were the scourge, and they were known for having slavery. Every African slave brought to America was purchased at a Muslim slave market right there in Africa. And anyway, so in Holland, they tell the kids, if you're good, St. Nicholas gives you presents. If you're naughty, his little Moorish helper, Zwarte Piet, will put you in a gunny sack and take you back to Spain and sell you into slavery. So often, when you tell a little kid Santa's coming, he'd start crying because he thought it might be his last night on earth. Now, in Germany, it was just the little helper was named Krampus, and he just put coal in your stocking, right? But in Holland, it was pretty serious. He'd put you in a gunny sack and haul you away. And so this guy on the radio interview, he says, yeah, I was raised over there, and every Christmas Eve, all the little boys would make sure to have pocket knives in their pockets. I said, why is that? He says, that's to cut ourselves out of the gunny sack in case Zwarte Piet took us. So, you know, Christmas Eve was a little more of a nervous time for the little boys back then. Forgot how I got into that. But anyway, so there's Nicholas's bones put over there because the Muslims invaded. And the Europeans sent crusades for 200 years. Crusades end. Muslims finally conquered Constantinople. And this is the Crusades. And then the Muslims would take the boys from the Christian families and not only make them Muslim soldiers, they would put them into their pederasty. I won't talk about that. But when they conquered Constantinople, this guy, and that's when they look for another way to get to Indian China, and that's when Columbus decides to sail west. And so Columbus would have never set sail to find a sea route to Indian China if the Muslims had not conquered the land routes to Indian China. And so this is Columbus. Now, it's sort of interesting. Columbus was born in what city? Genoa. And who was in Genoa 150 years earlier but Marco Polo? Marco Polo in 1271 went from Venice, Italy to China and worked for Kublai Khan, brought back spaghetti, coal, these burning rocks, gunpowder, thread from worms, silkworms, plates that were not made out of metal or wood, they were made out of China. We call it China because it came from China. And talked about Kublai Khan in China inventing paper currency. So paper currency that we use was invented by Kublai Khan. And he printed, and Marco Polo said, you could buy all this stuff with a piece of paper. And anyway, Kublai Khan printed too much of it, and that contributed to the Mongolian Empire falling. Maybe we should learn a lesson from that. But anyway, so China was technologically superior, and India was technologically, India had the teas, dyes, and spices. And so the Europeans wanted to trade with India and China. And Marco Polo comes back. And Marco Polo says that Kublai Khan told him and his father and uncle to bring back 100 teachers of the Christian faith, you know, doctors in your holy, to teach Christianity in China. And guess what? He comes over and the Pope just died and the new Pope's busy fighting a war. And so all he can scrounge up is two preaching friars, you know, from St. Francis's, the Franciscan friars, who are known for preaching. That was all they could get in 1271 to go back to, now this is a couple centuries before the Reformation, you know, and to go back to China. And these two preaching friars get scared crossing Turkey because the Muslims are fighting. They go back to Europe. And think how history would have been different. He had an open door during the Yuan Dynasty under Kublai Khan to teach Christianity in China. And so Columbus, so Marco Polo comes back and he's put in prison in Genoa. He's in a battle. The Venetians and Genoans were always fighting. So he's in prison in Genoa and he's laid up for a year and he starts telling his stories to another cellmate and the cellmate writes it down and it becomes a bestseller in Europe. Now this is 200 years before the printing press is invented. So the books had to be handwritten, you know. So there's lots of different copies with all kinds of different errors in it and different other, you know, traditions sort of work their way in there. But nevertheless, the stories of Marco Polo were some of the best known stories in Europe and they originated in Genoa. So 150 years later, after Marco Polo, Christopher Columbus was born in Genoa. So Christopher Columbus was aware of this Grand Khan, this Kublai Khan in China, asking for 100 teachers of the Holy Faith. So this is Columbus. This is his first journal voyage, and he writes to the king and queen, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, in this present year 1492, after your highness has made an end to the war with the Moors, the Muslims, who had ruled in Europe and had concluded the war in the very great city of Granada, and I saw the Moorish king come forth to the gates of the city and kiss your royal hands of your highnesses. In the same month, through information that I had given to your highnesses concerning the lands of India and a prince there who was called the Grand Khan or Kublai Khan. See, Kublai Khan's empire included northern India. And so Grand Khan, which meant King of Kings, how many times he and his predecessors had sent to Rome to seek doctors in our holy faith, to instruct him therein, and that never had the Holy Father provided them. Thus, so many people were lost through lapsing into idolatries. And your highnesses, devoted to the holy Christian faith and propagators thereof and enemies of the sect of Mohammed, resolved to send me, Christopher Columbus, to the said regions of India to see the said princes and peoples and the manner in which may be undertaken their conversion to our holy faith. So Columbus thought he was going to go to China. Here he is wandering around Cuba with a letter to the Grand Khan of China, wanting to talk about Christianity. He was trying to fit the Caribbean geography into the, you know, the Far East geography, because Florida he thought was Japan, you know, and Cuba he thought was the tip of China. And ordained that I should not go by land, the usual way to the Orient, but by the route of the Occident, that word means west, by which no one to this day knows for sure that anyone has gone. So, because the Muslims attacked the caravans and trade routes and cut off the land routes to India and China, Columbus said, hey, I'm going to do a new way. We're going to go the Occident, the West. And but he wanted to meet the Grand Khan and introduce him to our holy faith. So, the Muslims are driven out of Spain, but they still control this huge area. And see, they control the routes to get from Europe over to India and China. And then Martin Luther starts the Reformation. The Turk is the rod of the wrath of the Lord our God. If the Turk, God, the devil, is not beaten first, there is reason to fear the Turk will not be so easy to beat. The fight against the Turk must begin with repentance. We must reform our lives or we shall fight in vain. Our great and numberless sins and our ingratitude have earned God's wrath and disfavor so that he justly gives us into the hands of the devil and the Turk. The Turks were the Muslims. Anyway, there's the Battle of Lepanto, and then there's England, and Henry VIII was Catholic, and he decides to divorce his wife and ended up having seven wives. But I'm going to save some of that stuff to talk about in the main service, but I'm going to fast forward to, so you're getting a little sneak peek here. I'm going to fast forward to our colonies in America. And so for those that say, well, the founders didn't have any Christian faith. So here we have the Battle of Vienna, September 11, 1683, is when 200,000 Muslims surround Vienna. The Turks are continuing to invade, and that's when Jan Sobieski, he goes into the tents. He's there on horseback, goes into the tents, and he finds these bags of beans. And remember that story? These were coffee beans, and the coffee was the Muslims' drink, right? And it came from Ethiopia, and Ethiopia was the one African country to refuse to convert to Islam. Ethiopia stayed Christian, even to this day. It was called the Askamite Christian Empire, and then Abyssinia, or Ethiopia. And the Muslims called Christians kafirs, which means infidels. And so since these beans came from Ethiopia, they were called the kafir bean, or the coffee bean. And so it's the infidel bean. Now, after the Battle of Vienna, there was one of the Polish generals, George von Kleszczowski, he opened the first Vienna coffee house. And they weren't sure if they should drink coffee because it was the Muslims' drink. So they took a cup of it to Pope Clement. He tasted it and said, this is too good to leave for the Muslims. Let's baptize it. And then it spread across Europe. And so do you have your cup of infidel today? Pope said it's okay, though. Then the bakers in Vienna heard rumbling under the ground, and they told the soldiers, found out it was a tunnel the Muslims were digging, and the defenders blew up the tunnel, and afterwards they were going to reward the baker for warning him about this Muslim tunnel, and the baker said, I don't need a reward, just give me the sole permission to cook a pastry in the shape of the Muslim crescent to celebrate our victory, and it was called a croissant, the crescent roll. So the next time you have coffee and croissants, you can celebrate the victory of the Battle of Vienna, September 11, 1683. And this is the beginning of the end of the Ottoman Empire. This is when they got stopped. James Oglethorpe founded Georgia. He was a Christian. James Oglethorpe spent a couple years fighting the Muslims who were invading Serbia, goes back to England, and decides to start a colony in America for persecuted Protestants and those that were debtors. And this is the colony of Georgia. And so Georgia's charter in 1732, original charter for Georgia, says all persons except papists shall have a free exercise of their religion. Well, papists, papal, that's Catholic. Everybody except Catholics. So there was not a registered Catholic in Georgia until after the Revolutionary War, because they weren't allowed in. In Canada, when the British took over New France, because Canada was French and Canada was Catholic. When the British took over, a bunch of these French Catholics from Acadia flee Canada and get on the rivers and float down to New Orleans. And they want to go to Georgia, but they're not allowed to stay because they're papists. So they have to leave. So they go to the French territory of Louisiana. And so these French Acadians are down in Louisiana. And over the centuries, Acadian got pronounced how? Cajun. So the Louisiana Cajuns were the French Catholics that came down from Canada. Anyway, so Georgia, where James Oglethorpe founded, he had a secretary whose name was Charles Wesley. And later, Charles Wesley had a spiritual experience with his brother and with the Lord, and he decided to write hymns. And he wrote 6,000 hymns. And one of the Christmas carols that Charles Wesley wrote was what? Hark the Herald Angels Sing. That's a great one, though, Silent Night. But it was Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Glory to the newborn King. Anyway, and Charles Wesley's brother was who? John Wesley, who started the Methodist Church. Anyway, so here we are. We start these colonies, and the Muslims begin to capture our ship, so we're sending people with money to these Muslims to try to get them to stop capturing our ship. And here's President Obama. First nation recognized by country was Morocco. Well, Morocco was recognizing our country by capturing our ships and enslaving them. So in 1784, the Muslims captured the American ship Maria, and they paraded the crew through the streets of Algiers and mocked them as infidels, put them in prison. 1785, they captured two more American ships. Jefferson sent his ambassador to France, borrows 80,000 from the Dutch to ransom them back. Anyway, and so this is a little, gives you a little bit of idea. Then James Madison has to send in our Marines again. That's where we get the Marine anthem, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. And so we wouldn't have a Santa Claus if it wasn't for Islam. And this is the first war after our revolution. But Marines are called leathernecks because when they went to Tripoli, they knew the Muslims would slice off heads. And so they made these wide leather belts. It was very thick leather, and they would strap them around their neck so that the Muslims could, you know. So they were known to really stand up straight because they'd be wearing the leather thing. So they were called leathernecks. And then after they defeated the Muslims had their slave soldiers called Mamluks. And so they had these curved swords, and so it was called the Mamluk sword. So the Marine sword is called the Mamluk. And anyway, here's Stephen Decatur. He says, Algerians were believed to be masters of duplicity, willing to make agreements and break them when they found convenient. And anyway, I'm going to fast forward to this. These are two books I got. Matter of fact, I only got two of these left that I brought with me, the Backfired book. And as I mentioned before, every colony was started by a different... So the Muslims cut off the land routes to India, and so that's when Columbus set sail. And Columbus claimed all the New World for Spain. So the other colonies wouldn't even attempt to do a colony. Then the Spanish defeated the Muslim at the Battle of Lepanto, and then the Spanish took their armada and was going to squash the Reformation in England. And that's when their armada got smashed in a hurricane. And when the Spanish armada was smashed is when the other countries said, hey, Spain's not as tough as we thought. We can start colonies. And that's when all these other countries in Europe began this mad land rush, like the Oklahoma land rush, you know. They all began to hurry up and go to the New World and lay claim to start colonies. So Virginia was founded by Anglican Christians beginning in 1606. And it was established Anglican from 1606 to 1786. An establishment meant three things. Mandatory membership. Everybody in Virginia had to be an Anglican. Mandatory taxes. Everybody in Virginia had to pay taxes to the government, and the government paid the pastors. And you cannot hold public office in Virginia unless you were an Anglican. So the Baptist, Methodists, and Presbyterians were dissenters. And every now and then there'd be a lax governor who'd say, yeah, you can come in and live by the mountains. You can be a buffer between us and the Indians. And so that was the area of the Blue Ridge. James Madison writes about having Baptist revival meetings on his property. And Dolly Madison writes about having Thomas Jefferson over for dinner with a Baptist minister named, either Lorenzo Dowd or Andrew Tribble. Andrew Tribble was a Baptist revival preacher. And Dolly Madison writes that Jefferson kept asking him about the Baptist church government and said, it is possibly the only functioning form of true democracy that exists in the world, and it could be a good form of government for our U.S. government. So here, them say, oh, we don't want the church to influence the state. It's like nonsense. The church did influence the formation of the state. Anyway, Jefferson's daughter Martha went to one of these Baptist revival meetings. So on the East Coast, the Anglicans were really strict, but as you got closer to the mountains, they were a little bit looser. And so that's when you had some of these revivals. And so there's the first revival, called the Great Awakening, and then there was another revival called the Second Great Awakening. But anyway, Virginia was officially Anglican. And right before the Revolution, they had a new governor that really cracked down. And they were known to arrest Baptist ministers and stick them in the stocks and put them in jail. And there was one named Elijah Craig, I think is his name, and he was in the Orange County jail and would preach from the window for 3 months. And James Madison writes about going down there and hearing him preach. There'd be a crowd that would gather on the window. His crime was he was caught preaching without a license from the king, because all the Anglican ministers had to have licenses from the king. And then there was Patrick Henry. And he was an Anglican, but he rode all the way to Spotsylvania to defend three Baptist ministers who were on trial. And he, as the defense attorney, He stands up and he says, what is this I hear, your lordships, you know, addressing the judges, that these men are on trial for preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ, you know, putting a little guilt trip on them, like, why are you persecuting these people? And but they were known to break into the church and grab the Baptist minister from the pulpit and drag him out to the creek and nearly drown the guy. Say, here, you want to be baptized? And so James Madison was in the Virginia legislature, and he passes a law to punish disturbers of religious worship. Well, whose religious worship was getting disturbed? It was the Baptists. And so after the Revolution, we got rid of the king, but Virginia had been an Anglican colony with all their laws written that had the king in there. And so they said, oh, we got to rewrite all of our Virginia laws and erase the king. And when it came down to the laws regarding religion, Jefferson was going to rewrite those. And the Baptist, Methodist, and Presbyterians came up to Jefferson and said, can you please disestablish the Anglican denomination? I mean, look, we just rebelled against the king. Why should we keep this church as the official state church? Because believe it or not, Patrick Henry, George Washington, and a bunch of other ones wanted to keep the Anglican denomination as the official denomination. They said, yeah, it provides structure, you know, and so forth. And so Jefferson and Madison were the heroes because they pushed through, and they did all the politics because Patrick Henry was pushing and pushing and pushing to keep the, they got rid of the king, they just called it Episcopal. And so Madison sort of arranged for Patrick Henry to get elected governor, which he was governor five times, but it got him out of the legislature, and it's the legislature that wrote the laws. And so that's when they pushed through a law to disestablish the Anglican denomination. And those that were against disestablishing it were called what? Anti-disestablishmentarians. And that used to be the longest word in the English language, you know, anti-disestablishmentarianism. What's that? That's those that are against disestablishing the Anglican denomination. And another coup happened in 1785. See, this is the year they voted on it, 1786. In 1785 is when Francis Asbury, who was a Methodist circuit riding preacher, he decided to split the Methodist revival movement outside of the Anglican Church and make it into its own denomination. So Charles Wesley and John Wesley, they were Anglicans. They died Anglican. They were loyal Anglicans. They just wanted to bring a revival inside of the Anglican denomination. And they'd hold their big revival meetings, and, you know, George Whitefield would preach, but they were all still Anglicans, even though they were, you know, reaching out to everybody. But Francis Asbury, and so when the Revolutionary War started, all these Anglican preachers went back to England. But the ones that were the revival preachers, who were the Methodists inside the Anglican church, they stayed. And one of them was Francis Asbury. And he preached all the way from Canada down to the Gulf of Mexico. And he rode 300,000 miles on horseback. And, you know, he would go to little towns and they would preach up, and, you know, and they called them circuit riding preachers because they have a circle of cities that they just keep going to, right? And Francis Asbury actually met George Washington, congratulated him on his election. And Francis Asbury helped start the first African church in America, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, AME. And anyway, so in 1785, Francis Asbury splits the Methodist movement out of the Anglican church. So now the Anglicans don't have a majority. And so when the vote comes up on whether Virginia should keep the Anglican denomination as the official established denomination, they don't have the votes. And so that's when they disestablish it. And all of the Protestant denominations are like thrilled. Like now we don't have to pay taxes to keep this state church in place. We can use all of our own money to help our churches. And so they disestablished it. And by the way, the first Catholic church in Virginia was 1795. This is after the Declaration, after the Constitution, after the First Amendment. Why? Because it was illegal to have a Catholic church in Virginia prior to then. Anyway, so it gives you a little picture of what's going on in America. And for those people to say, oh, they are all deists and atheists back then, it's like, duh, what history are you reading? They were so jealously attached to their own denomination that they had been chasing each other out. Or this is, you know, I'm from New York, you know, New Amsterdam. We're a Dutch Reformed colony. And Delaware and New Jersey were originally Swedish Lutheran colonies, and they'd chase out the Quakers, and they'd chase out the Anglicans, and then Massachusetts was a Puritan colony, and they'd chase out the Anglicans, and they'd chase out the Quakers, and then New York was Dutch Reformed, they'd chase out. The Quakers were chased out everywhere. And one of the quotes I have in my book is from the Puritans in Massachusetts, and one of the Puritan leaders, to show you how sort of intolerant they were to the other denominations, he says... this is from Cotton Mather, and he writes, "To ye aged and beloved Mr. John Higginson, now there is a ship at sea called the Welcome, which on board has 100 or more of those heretics and malignants called Quakers, with W. Penn, who is the chief scamp at the head of them. The General Court of Massachusetts accordingly has given secret orders to Master Malachi Huscott of the brig Porpoise to waylay the said Welcome slyly as near the Cape of Cod as may be, and make captive of the said Penn and his ungodly crew, so the Lord may be glorified and not mocked on the soil of this new country with the heathen worship of these people. Much spoil can be made by selling the whole lot to Barbados, where slaves fetch a good price." So those Puritans were not very tolerant of the other ones. It's sort of interesting. In England, it was Anglican, and they persecuted the Puritans because the Puritans were wanting to purify the Church of England. And when the Pilgrims made it in America for 9 years, from 1620 to 1629, the Puritans in England got tired of being persecuted, so they fled. 20,000 of them fled, and they settled in Massachusetts. And they're in Massachusetts, and they're thinking, you know what? We don't like the state telling us what to believe, but over here, we are the state. 20,000 of them, I mean, they control everything. So then they sort of change their tune. They, well, maybe it's not such a bad thing that the state determines what the churches have to believe. Well, lo and behold, from England to America comes a Baptist preacher named Roger Williams. And he's preaching at a little dissenting church, and he's saying the state shouldn't tell the church what to believe. And somebody goes to him and says, "Didn't you get the memo? Over here, we sort of like the state telling the church what to believe." Well, he keeps preaching it. He gets chased out to Rhode Island, and that's where he starts the First Baptist Church in America. And gets a bunch of other different followers, and the guy in Massachusetts, John Cotton or something, he decides to try to annex Rhode Island and bring it into Massachusetts. And so that's when Roger Williams has to go back to England to try to get a charter. Well, the king would never have approved it. But the king had just got his head chopped off by the Puritans that stayed in England. They had a civil war and won. And so Sir Henry Vane sort of liked Roger Williams. He went ahead and signed the charter for Rhode Island that didn't have a king requiring them to be Anglican. So Roger Williams comes back. He lands at Boston, and he's got his charter with him. He goes, "I got my own land, you know." And anyway, when he was in England, Roger Williams printed a message. It's called The Tenet of Persecution, Bloody Tenet of Persecution for Conscience Sake. So he was getting all upset at the fact that the state was determining what churches were supposed to believe. And he said that it's because of our sin that God has allowed this situation where the state's determining the church is faith. Because of the early church, they never had the Roman Empire telling them what to believe. And so Roger Williams quotes from Isaiah 3, where it says, "My well-beloved had planted a vineyard and put a wall around it, and then Kent went to check to see if there were grapes, and lo, he only found wild grapes. And so what will he do? He'll tear down the wall and let his vineyard be trampled. But if the people repent," so he says, the children of Israel are the garden, and God looked for justice and only found injustice. And so what is he going to do? He's going to let Jerusalem and Israel get trampled. And so he says, the church is the garden. And because of our sins, God let the wall of the garden get torn down, and he let us get trampled. So now the state's coming in and telling us what to believe. That's when he writes this one phrase. He says, "If the church repents, God will rebuild the wall of separation between church and state, thus protecting his garden." That phrase, wall of separation of church and state, was understood from that time all the way up to, 1947, that the wall was to protect the church from having an IRS agent come in to listen to the pastor and arrest the pastor and lock him away. It was to keep, the wall was to keep the state out of the church. And then Proverbs has the same thing. I went by the garden of a slothful man, and I saw the wall broken down, and it was all overrun, you know. And so the wall was always symbolic of protection of the church's freedoms. Anyway, so there was the Baptists in Connecticut, and I know I'm running out of time here. The Baptists in Connecticut wrote a letter to Thomas Jefferson saying, we don't like the fact that in Connecticut it's an established congregational state, and the government makes us second-class citizens, and he says, we believe that religion is between something between man and his God. And Jefferson writes back, he says, I agree with you that religion is something between man and his God because there's a wall of separation between church and state. So Jefferson uses this phrase, separation of church and state, assuring the Baptists that he agrees with them that the congregational church in Connecticut should not be, you know, persecuting the Baptist church in Connecticut. And so that was the phrase, separation of church and state, that Jefferson used in that context. And it was only in 1947 that they took it out and twisted it around to mean something totally different. Anyway, I'm out of town. A lot of that's in the book Backfired, and I am assuming that it's about time for me to quit. So I'll look back to finishing up in the main service. Did you get something out of this morning? All right. Well, God bless you, and I don't know who should I turn it over to, but it's time for me to quit, right, Bob? Yeah, okay. I'll go ahead and let you get ready.